I'd like to thank the Arts Council England for sponsoring this event and recently sponsoring the next 3 years of the festival at least. And also Ormond Slade, the local solicitors, who've kindly also sponsored this event. The Guardian has described Ian McMillan as a force of nature. Certainly, his work has a verbal energy of a thunderstorm, the rhythmic force of a hurricane, the wicked wit of a will-o'-the-wisp, and the imaginative fertility equivalent to the Nile in flood. Versatile enough to be poet in residence at Barnsley Football Club and for the English National Opera and the judge of our current poetry competition. Vocal enough to be judged 22nd most powerful person on radio. And also... I think he's down the 21st, is he? He'll go up from this evening onwards. Okay, and also... enough variety in himself and his performance to be compared at various times to Spike Milligan, Eric Morecambe and Shirley Bassey. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Ledbury, Ian McMillan.
Hey, come on then. Thank you very much indeed. What a wonderful introduction. That was a fantastic, fantastic introduction. The other day, I was a prize in a competition, a poetry competition. It was fantastic. I don't know what the second prize was. But I was at this little school in Cheshire, and I was the prize. The prize was a morning with me at this school. It was a nice prize. And the teacher was really excited. She went, "We're so excited." What I've done is, Mrs. Smith, our music teacher, is going to play a specially composed fanfare, and then you can start. I said, "Great." So I'm stood there. She went, "We're really excited." I said, "Good." And she said, "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, please welcome one of Britain's leading poets, Mr. Ian Bland." And this woman went, "Duh," and there was a terrible silence. And I went to this woman, "I'm not Ian Bland." And she went, "Who are you?" And I said, "Ian McMillan." She went, "I've never heard of you." I said, "Well, who's Ian Bland?" She went, "I've never heard of him either." I said, "Well, it's just the name on the paper." So then these kids go, they go, Ian Bland. So I'm not Ian Bland. So it's nice to be introduced properly. That is very nice. And then I thought, well, if I was a poet, if I was called Ian Bland, I'd change my name because it's not a very exciting name. I call myself Ian Exciting or Ian Dynamic. Then it turns out there actually is a children's poet called Ian Bland. So I apologise to Ian Bland. But anyway, I'm not him. And I think what I like very much about the Ledbury Poetry Festival is that they always introduce you properly, which is nice. And also, fantastic publicity. Wonderful publicity for this poetry festival. It tells you who you are, what you're going to see, how long the event's going to last, where it is. I want to show you. I showed you some of these last time I came, but I've got some new ones. The kind of publicity that I've had that hasn't been quite as good. I did a performance at Melton Mowbray Library, because I do all the hotspots. It was part of the Melton Mowbray Comedy Festival. And this was their entire publicity. Funny poet here. And I got there and I said, "Is that it?" They said, "No, there's one on the back door as well." I said, "Oh, good." And three people turned up and one of them said, "Oh, we thought it might be you." I said, "Yes, that's the power of advertising." In fact, my smallest audience ever was -2. That sounds made up, but it's true. If you go up the M1 to Toddington Services, at the back of there, there's the village of Toddington. There's a pub there called the Sow and Pigs, where the Toddington Poetry Society meet. And I was their guest poet. And I got there, and there were two people in the audience, and they were the organisers. And they said, "What happens is, we read our poems, then you do yours." I said, "Right." And they read theirs and went home. And they said, "We'd like to stay, but we can't." I said, "Oh, good." And I still read my poems to empty room. That's deeply tragic. So I collect these notices. People say, "What's this got to do with poetry?" Well, it has, because you know about in this festival that being a poet is about observing things. It's about noticing things. It's about listening into things. So I did a performance at Lincoln Central Library, and there's this wonderful notice on the front desk, a very small one. I'll read it out to you. Just it tells you a bit about life in Lincoln. Little handwritten notice on the front desk, and it says, "We do not supply washing up liquid." You think, well, what kind of library is that? 2 Catherine Cookson's, the bottle of squeezy, please. And I said to the woman, "Can I have that notice?" And she said, "I'll have to make another one." I said, "That's all right, but in your own time." I've only ever been to the wrong place once. There were two schools next door to each other in Knutsford in Cheshire. And I got there, and I was supposed to start at 10:30. And I got there at 9:30. And I walked in, they went, "You're late." I said, "Really?" They said, "Yes, no time for intro, just start." And I went in this school hall, and there's 200 kids looking at me. And they went, "Just start, just start." So I'm doing my poems that normally get laughs, and nobody was laughing. And the teachers at opposite ends of the room, looking at each other, going, like that. And the kids have all got worksheets, looking like that. And at the end, there was desultory applause. And the teacher stood up and said, "Well, children, I can honestly say that's the most unusual talk we've ever had from the Cheshire Fire Brigade. Because I was in the wrong school. I don't know where the fireman was. He must have been next door. These are strange poems. And why has he brought an axe? Why is he wearing a yellow hat?" I've lived all my life in a place called Darfield near Barnsley. And not far from there, there's a place called Skelmanthorpe, which is known locally as Shat. Because there used to be stone shatterers. There used to be a quarry there, there's stone shatterers. There's actually a taxi firm there called Shat Taxis, which sounds like a quite a difficult thing to attempt. And this... I did a performance at their youth centre, and this is their code of conduct. It's wonderful. Code of conduct. No bullying, no smoking, no alcohol, no drugs, no fighting, no antisocial behaviour, no stealing, no swearing, respect everybody, speak to staff members if you've got any worries, help you keep youth club tidy, pay your subs, respect the building, football on the football court only, have fun. That's the best bit, have fun. And that's in a different colour. Sometimes these notices are totally unfathomable. I found this one in a school in Castleford in West Yorkshire. Do not trip over the feet. Doesn't tell you which feet. Any feet, it don't matter. And sometimes they are totally surreal. I found this one. You know, sometimes somebody's lost a dog or a cat and they put a notice on a tree. And I found this on a tree between two villages in Devon. And it's kind of unfathomable and it's beautiful and it's kind of poetic. And it just goes, "Where can we go to watch people play badminton and eat our sandwiches?" You think, yes. Where can we go? I've got no idea. And it says badminton. It's got a thing round it. I've no idea. And now that I've pinched it, they'll never know. They'll never know where to play. They're going to have no idea where to play badminton and eat their sandwiches. And it just strikes me that as poets, that's what we should be. And as people who read poetry and write poetry, we should observe all the time. We should notice things. I was doing a performance in a place called Ierby up in the Lake District. And there was a very small village hall. And they were really pleased because they'd had the village all done up. And they got some changing rooms round the back. And they got these new changing rooms that they insisted that I use. And these changing rooms, two wonderful notices in the changing room. The first one says, "Please do not close the curtains." You think, well, that's strange, because it's a changing room. Surely you should close the curtains. Then this other one that says, "Please switch the stairs lights off. If you can read this, you've not switched them off," which is fantastic. So I said, "Well, what's the point of that notice that says don't shut the curtains?" I said, "Well, if you shut the curtains, you can't see that one." They said, "Don't switch them off." Sometimes, again, they're kind of philosophical. I found this one in a little village near Huddersfield, and it tells you what's important in life. It just says, "It's important to move the piano slowly over the grates." That's what's important in life, nothing else, just that. And then another one that features a piano is this one. Again, this is quite philosophical. It just tells you, it found it in a church in Norfolk, and it just says, "Please place nothing on this piano. Not, do not place anything on this piano, but go and get some nothing and put it on the piano." Very strange. I'll show you, this is my latest one that I found the other day. I was really excited about it, and it's kind of practical. It's found it in a school in Leicestershire. It just says, "Please do not remove this extinguisher from the wall unless there is a fire." And that's practical. I like that. I've been doing this job now for 35 years, standing up in public and talking and writing. And you think, well, where does it come from? How come you end up doing this? How come you end up as a writer? There's several reasons. The first reason, I think, is that my dad had this auntie who was a poet. She was called Bella Howardson. She was born in 1862, and she wrote Victorian rhyming ballads. And she used to write my dad these rhyming letters that he kept, and he used to read them to me. You think, well, maybe then, if writing comes to you through your DNA, and that's where it came from. And then I thought about my mum and dad. My dad was that very rare thing, a teetotal Scottish sailor. There are very few of them. And they have quite dull AGMs involving discussions on Vimto and Ribena. And my mum was from Great Alton, the next village to where I live in Barnsley. And my mum and dad met during the war as pen pals. My dad was in the Navy. My mum was in the WAFs. And they used to write to each other. It was a scheme they had where service people could write to each other. And my mum and dad wrote to each other for 2 years and gradually, through these letters, fell in love and tried to meet. Because it was the war, it was really hard to meet. So they agreed to meet in the Queen's Hotel in Leeds sometime in 1941 for afternoon tea. And my dad had docked at Plymouth. And my mum was at the RAF, an RAF Blackbrook it was called, near Wigan. And she got, and they tried to meet. And because of the wartime trains, they just missed each other. Just missed each other. And they only met twice before they got married. And then my dad sent this fantastic telegram that said, "Get leave now." And my mum telegrammed back, "Cannot get leave." Because my dad had got a 48-hour pass. And he landed in Plymouth and came up towards Peebles in Scotland, where they got married. My mum pleaded with the people at RAF Blackbrook to let her go, but they won't let her go. So eventually what she did was she got her mate Mavis to talk to officer, distract him, and my mum climbed over the fence. Went AWOL for love, got on a train at Wigan Wallgate Station, went across. My dad was pacing up and down outside the church. She almost didn't make it. She just made it. She ran. My dad told this story endlessly. She ran up the main street of Peebles, Peebles High Street, and they just got married. They had one night of passion together in the Tontine Hotel, Peebles. Then my dad went off to the Far East on secret war work for 2 years. My mum went back to RAF Blackbrook and got arrested 2 weeks in Glasshouse for love. And that was one of their defining stories. You think, well, maybe that's why I'm a writer, because they were brought together by writing. Letters brought them together. Sadly, they threw a lot of them away, but they kept some. And my dad, his spelling got more and more erratic the more excited he got. I remember he put to Olive, "When we get together, we will have some fun." And he spelt fun with five N's. That's how excited he got. Have some fun. And that story was always their abiding myth. You know, every night, my dad come home from work, when he left the Navy, he went to work in a firm in Sheffield, and he'd come home from work, and they'd often tell that story. You think, well, that's the other reason I'm a writer. It's because great-aunt Bella Howardson, and it's because of my mum and dad getting together through this romantic, romantic story. Then the other reason that I'm a writer is because of the school I went to. I was lucky enough. I'm 58 years old. I was born in 1956. So I was lucky enough to go to a West Riding County primary school in the 60s. And the West Riding was a wonderful education authority run by a godlike genius called Sir Alec Clegg. And Sir Alec Clegg said that all children are creative and that everybody can write and everybody can sing and everybody can dance. And our junior school, just like an ordinary mucky school in a mucky pit village, but it was like an arts centre. We had a string quartet that came every term and played the same string quartet by Haydn that stops and then starts again. And it fooled us every time. They stop and go, "Hey, they start again." You know, got us again. They used to have a thing called the West Riding Abstract Art Van. It had square wheels. That's not true. It had, the driver had both eyes on the same side of his head. That's a lie. And they'd say, "I want six big boys for the abstract art." And we'd go, "Oh, me, sir." And we'd carry these paintings out and we'd say, "What do they mean, sir?" And they said, "They mean what they look like, boy. And this afternoon, you're going to do some paintings like that. Then you're going to do a dance about it. Then you're going to sing about it. Then you're going to write about it." And it felt to me that junior school was so affirmative. It said to me, "You can be a writer. You can do it." Mr. Meakin, Alan Meakin, who's only just retired a few years ago from adult education, he took me on one side and said, "Ian, you can be a poet. If you want to, you can be a poet." And that's why I love the Ledbury Poetry Festival, because it actually says that we can all do this. We can all do the poets. There's a lot of workshops, not just people standing here spouting poetry. There's actually about writing poetry. And I often think there are some good times in your life, and I'm enjoying being 58, but I loved being top of junior school. That was so fantastic. Mrs. Roach got us writing poems. Although I must say, one day she said to me, "Ian, if you don't tidy your desk up, I'll cut your tail off," which was a bit drastic. And she went off for a couple of days, came back, and then I'd forgotten all about it. She'd forgotten all about it. I hadn't. And we were cutting some cardboard up, and she went, "Ian, get the guillotine." So I ran home. And but it were teachers like that that we remember that said, "Yes, you can be a writer." So that's the other reason I'm a writer. So it's great Aunt Bella Howardson, it's my mum and dad, and it's the junior school that I went to. And then I left there, and I went to Worth Grammar School, the same school as our glorious Foreign Secretary. The reason he's got that high forehead, William Hague, is that we used to rub his head on the windows when he came in. He made an amusing sound. He'd say, "You better stop that, I'll be a future leader at Tory Party." We never believed him. But we got there, and I was very excited to be first year secondary school. I wanted to be a writer. I got there. We were taught English by this lady called Mrs. Smith. And I said to Mrs. Smith, "Mrs. Smith, are we going to be writing our own poems?" She went, "No, for the next five terms, we're going to be doing The White Company by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle." And I thought it was three people. I thought it was Sir Arthur, Conan, and Doyle, his mate. And we did that terrible thing called reading round the class, where you sit there going, "Oh, blimey, in about 5 weeks, it'll be my go." And you read a bit, then it passes from you. You think, is that it? And luckily for me, I can tell you this because I'm amongst friends, Mrs. Smith gradually went mad. And her madness was shown. She became obsessed by her feet. She'd walk into class and go, "Get out your White Company." She's looking at her shoes. And we're going, "There's something to it, Mrs. Smith." Then she's putting her shoes on the desk, going, "Get out your White Company." Eventually, we're doing "Far From the Madding Crowd" by Thomas Hardy. And she stood up on a desk at Bucket Room and took her shoes off and threw them to Bucket Room and said the words, "I'm fed up with teaching, far from the maddening crowd, far from the muddening ground." And we thought, "There's something to it, Mrs. Smith," because we're perceptive in Barnsley. We notice things. And She was taken away and replaced by a man called Mr. Brown. Now, Mr. Brown is the person who really got me back into writing. I think a lot of us in the room are poets, and we can point maybe to one teacher at school who got us going, and for me it was Mr. Brown. And he walked in the class, and for a start, he was tall and handsome, which is very rare in South Yorkshire. He'd got a beard. Nobody had seen a beard in Barnsley in 1970. When he walked down the street in Barnsley in 1970 with a beard, somebody says to him, "What do you keep in there, ferrets or loose change?" And also, he was wearing a green corduroy suit. We'd seen nothing like that before. My mate says to me, "Why is he wearing a corrugated iron shed?" And he walked in, and he got all these pens in his top pocket. He got a Jack Kerouac book of poems in his pocket, and he was so bohemian. But the great thing about Mr. Brown was his voice. He walked in. We all stood there, and he walked in, and he went, "Hello, students." We went, "Blimey, what's this?" He went, "Get out your straight edges." We went, "Straight edges? He means rulers." And he was fantastic. He said, "Right, we're all going to write some poems." I went, "No, Mrs. Smith said we had to finish off Far From Madding Crowd." He said, "No, we're all going to write some poems." And we all wrote poems for him. He did that simple thing where he printed them out, made a little book of our poems, said, "Look, you can be a poet." It was thanks to him again that I'm a poet. The one thing I disagree with him was that I wrote an essay for him. And I was so thick that I thought essay was spelt S full stop, A full stop, and it stood for special assignment. And I put, "My S.A. by Ian Macmillan, future Nobel Prize for Literature winner." And he took me on one side. He said, "Ian, Nobel Prizes for Literature winners don't come from Barnsley." And I thought, oh, that's a shame. I think they can. But Mr. Brown was the one. So it's my great Aunt Bella. It's Mr. Brown. It's the West Riding. It's my mum and dad. I lost touch with Mr. Brown for years. Then about 20 years ago, I was sat watching the telly during a World Cup. And suddenly the phone rang and it's Mr. Brown. I went, "Hello, it's Mr. Brown on the phone." And he went, "Turn on your TV now." And I switched my telly on, and you might remember years ago, there was an advert for Lynx shampoo, where these cave women got attacked by dinosaurs, and they took the bras off and put a rock in the bra and threw the rock, and it went, "The Lynx effect." And that was Mr. Brown doing the voice, because he'd packed up teaching. He had two terms at our school. They went down to London, and the first day in London, he went into this pub, and he went, "Pint of bitter." And this man went, "Is that your voice?" And he went, "Yes." And he said, "Follow me to this recording studio, your fortune's made." So every time this Lynx effect advert was on, he got 20 quid, so he was really rich. And the reason he was ringing me up was he was coming to see some mates in Rotherham. So he says, "I'm coming to see some mates in Rotherham. Can I come and see you?" I said, "Yeah." And I've got three kids, 31, 29 and 25. They haven't got names, just numbers. I find it easier. Some places don't get that one. I won't name names. Chesterfield, they rang me. And anyway, so I said to my kids, "Mr. Brown's coming, the Lynx effect man." They said, "Will he say the Lynx effect?" I said, "Well, I'll try and work it in the conversation if you like." So I met him at the door, and he drove up in a big posh car because he was so rich, because every time the advert was on, he got 20 quid. And I said, "Mr. Brown," I still call him Mr. Brown. I said, "Mr. Brown, the kids are really excited. Can you say the Lynx effect? Not for me, just for the kids." And he went, "Yeah." And he walked in the room, and the kids had stood there in a delegation, and he went, "The Lynx effect." And kids clapped, which I thought was nice. And then he gave me an invoice for 20 quid, which I thought was a bit much. That's not true, I made that up. In fact, I've done a couple of voiceovers. They're interesting things. They're very interesting things for poets and for people who are interested in language and literature, because you have to think very hard about a very few words. I did one for Persil Blue Gel. And they said, "What you're going to do is you've got to go, Persil Blue Gel, it gets tough stains out." I went, "All right." So I went, "Persil Blue Gel, it gets tough stains out." And he said, "That word tough, can you make it a bit more mysterious?" So you have to go, "Persil Blue Gel, it gets stains out." And then they use very specific language. They go, "That word stains. Can you feather it away halfway through, then return it on the cusp?" You go, "Right." She goes, "Persil Blue Gel, it goes tough stains out." And then they go, "That word out. Can you make it go up at the end?" And in normal conversation, you go down, you go tough stains out. You have to go tough stains out. Like that. And you do about 500. Then they go, "We quite like take 98. You go, "Thank you very much. It sounds like all the rest." So that's the people I thank to be a writer. I've written a poem about them. I've written a poem about the people who got me into being a writer. And it's just really more or less what I've told you. And it's a kind of list of these people, because they're the ones that you want to thank. A lot of us in this room are poets and want to thank certain people, and this is them. If this is an acceptance speech, then these are the ones to thank. Great Aunt Bella Howardson, who wrote rhyming letters to me dad that he read slowly, leaning over that great dull stone sink at Fowler Cottage. If rhyme is in your DNA, then I'm very glad to say she put it there. And can I thank the wartime postal system, chugging those letters across continents and seas that boiled and sprayed and heaved and took words and lines from those young seasick lovers and scattered them across their lives like tumbling leaves, leaves that fall through the years. And can I thank the West Riding of Yorkshire, and Sir Alec Clegg, who taught me we're all creative and that a playground game leads straight to Shakespeare and the harsh sound of a clog can echo through your veins until it holds you like a rhyme that you remember as you dance. And can I thank Rob Brown, English teacher in a green suit, who told me it was okay to try to become a poet, that even though my voice was more a theremin than a flute, I had something inside me and I should try to grow it, even if the growing made it coarser. And the reason I talk about my voice being more a theremin than a flute, because when I first met Mr. Brown, my voice had only just broken. So I don't like that. And the other thing I can say for Mr. Brown is that he introduced me to the lady who's been my wife for the last 35 years. And I fancied her, but I daren't say. So I said to Mr. Brown, I like that Catherine Goldthorpe in class 51. And he went, I'll tell her. And, oh, good. And I remember, I've got a vivid memory of him going down the corridor and her looking up and him going, and her looking up and going, like that. And, but things have got better since then. But they, and then you think, well, where else does poetry come from? And for me as well, it comes from singing. I think poetry is so close to singing. My dad would sing all the time, but he only ever sang two songs. The first one was Donald, Where's Your Trousers? But he wouldn't sing the whole thing. He wouldn't sing, let the wind blow, hey, let the wind blow low, through the streets of my kilt I go. He'd just sing a bit of it, because he assumed we all knew the rest. So he'd go, let the wind. That was it. And then it got less. He just go, let. And I said, why don't you sing the whole thing? He said, well, we all know it. And also, his second favourite song was Puppet on a String by Sandy Shaw. And there was actually a small time of conciliation where he put them both together. So instead of singing Donald, Where's Your Trousers and Put Me on a String, he'd sing Donald, Where's Your Puppet on a String. But again, instead of singing, I wonder if one day that, you'll say that, you care, he'd just go, hey, and that was it. And it just struck me that the rest of it was in his head. And then eventually, as he got older and older, the last thing he did, not long before he died, the day he died, he was still singing. And you think, right, that's what stays with you, singing. So this is just called Andy and Sandy, about my dad's two great heroes, Andy Stewart and Sandy Shaw. When I was on Desert Island Discs, I chose Donald Where's Your Trousers, which would be a great thing, although then I thought about it, I thought being stuck on a desert island for all them years with Donald Where's Your Trousers might not be a great thing. My dad loved to sing. His sweet tenor voice filled UHE8 those long Sunday afternoons between home and Brearley Crossroads, Oughton Woods, and the slow road home in third trundle gear as my dad sang like Andy Stewart or Sandy Shaw, Donald Where's Your Trousers and Puppet on a String over and over, looping and dancing as that bright blue car passed the house where he told us Dick Durpin lived with his horse Black Beauty. I know it was Black Bess, but that was my dad's joke. Every Sunday he'd go, Black Beauty, and we had to go, hmm. The songs shrunk. Over the years, they became small photographs of themselves. Just the first line, just the first couple of words. I wonder, because we all knew the rest, the rhythms living in our souls like the route home. And then you shrunk. That stroke sat you in the chair and wouldn't let you get up to change the channels on the television as the carers came and went like Sunday afternoons, but somewhere in there you were singing. And he was, and I think in the end, maybe singing is the one thing that keeps us all going. We like to sing. Singing is the thing. And then, because it was a particular kind of school that I went to, my careers advice was a bit like the careers advice in Kez, because everybody went down the pit, unless you were clever, in which case you worked at the pit offices. And they had these special NCB recruiting films they used to show us. And they used to show us these NCB recruiting films in junior school, which was daft, really, but also there was no white space in the school to watch the films, so they used to show them in cloakroom. So it was really weird because you'd see them and all the film was actually on some pegs and there was like weird bits of duffel coat in amongst people's heads and it was really strange. And the teacher was called Mr. Challenger. I remember that. He said, my name's Mr. Challenger and I am. Strange. So this is just what happened with Mr. And we also had this really ancient projector that Mr. Challenger insisted on using. Called NCB Recruiting Film 1964. They've taken us into the boys' cloakroom to watch it. It was the darkest place they could find. Well, it always was for David Rotherham. At one end, Mr. Challenger fiddled with the projector. Suddenly, the music started and a vicarish voice began the story. The nation needs coal and the nation needs miners. And, decades later, I wondered why they didn't bother to move the coats. So the pitmen moved and shimmered over gabardines and duffels and macs, spare pegs sticking from the snap tins, helmets lighting a scarf. The projector kept speeding up and slowing down, smoking and gasping at its own smoke. Mr. Challenger clipped it, and it raced itself to a finishing line that none of us could guess. The voice Mickey Mousing and the pitmen running, running, to a place of sudden darkness, because suddenly it hit the projector and it went very, very fast. And they ran backwards out of the pit, these fellows, and got on the pit bus and went backwards back to their house. It was quite amazing. It was interesting how we had to do an essay for Mr. Challenger, Barnsley in the year 2000. And in the essay it said, we'll all eat our tea in tablet form, and we'll all wear silver space suits, and we'll go to the pit on a silver monorail. Because we all thought everything else might change, but the pit wouldn't. The pit would always be there. And that's the interesting thing about the place that I've lived all my life. It has changed in so many ways, so many interesting ways. So I was thinking about that when I was thinking about age. And I'm only 58, but you think about age and how things alter. And because you're 58, as you know, gentlemen in the room, certain things start to happen. Not that thing, no, the other thing, not that one. And this is just called old age. I'm not old, but this is called old age. Old age is simply this. Put a penny on to do the pots, then forget. And put another penny on to do the pots. Penny on penny. Two penny morning. Penny penny fastened at the back. A penny on a penny. A double penny moment. And the pot's not done. And my wife says to me, you've got two pennies on. I said, yeah, that's how they're wearing them this year in Ledbury. And then, because I'm 58, my first yearnings of desire were for Emma Peel off The Avengers. I really fancied her. She was great. I didn't know why. My voice was breaking, like I said before, and I said to my mum, I like that lady. I like that lady on the television, and I'd like to protect her and buy her some shorts. And so, my mum said to me, Dad, you better tell him facts of life. So my dad took me in the garden and put his arm around me and told me facts of life, and this is what he told me. And like I said before, my dad's a very innocent kind of fella. And you've got to remember that there's me and my dad and my mum and my brother, our John. And the other thing that happened was, when I was getting to adolescence, as well as my voice breaking, overnight, I got one long hair out of my chest like that, about 9 miles long, huge. My brother used to pluck it out, then he'd come back the next day. It was like a strange thing. And also, we had a canary in a cage, like a lot of people did. And every night, my mum would put a tea towel over it. I'd ask why, she said, so it don't get too excited. Go, oh. We called it Dickie, after Dickie Bird. As we call him in Barnsley, Dickie, it's not my round bird. And so this is the facts of life, as far as I know, because this is all that he told me. It's called Black Cloud Over My House Sometime in the 1960s. Look, that cloud, black as Emma Peel's leather trousers, on our black and white television in that front room with a canary in the corner. Emma. Maybe trousers isn't the right word. Pants. Skin. That cloud seems tight, full tight. My voice is cracking at the edges, and there's a single hair on my chest, like a wire or a spider's thigh. I showed it to our John, and he laughed. Saturday night, me and Emma in the front room, and our John, and me dad, and me mam, and the canary singing, and my single hair, and her trousers. Me dad joins me in the garden, puts his arm round me. There'll be a cloudburst soon, he says, his voice lilting. That was it. That's all he told me. That was the entire facts of life. That's all I got. I don't know what else there is. That's all it is. So then, I think that I've always lived in the same place, and I think one of the great signifiers of South Yorkshire, and Yorkshire in particular, is the Yorkshire pudding. I love Yorkshire puddings. They're a great thing. We still have them as a first course on a Sunday. And I said to my wife, we're having these as a cultural thing. It's a cultural moment as a first course. She says things like, there's not many up our street having these. I said, no, there's not, but we are. So this is my kids, they prefer Aunt Bessie's, which are terrible. They taste like either wash leathers or beer mats. And I think I prefer a proper one. Because the thing I like about Yorkshire puddings is, no matter how you mix them, the same, and the oven's always the same heat, they turn out different. Last Sunday, mine were terrible for some reason. The Sunday before, they rose like chef's hats. And you think, why? So that's why I like them. They're always different. So I wrote this, and I did this at a charity event at Sheffield Cathedral. And something terrible happened at the end with the Bishop of Sheffield, which I'll tell you about. I know you're right to gasp in amazement, but that's what it was. The Bishop wasn't too pleased either, but I'll come to that. This mentions my Uncle Jack, who I'll tell you about later, who went to, it was in the Western Desert. And he was fighting in the Western Desert, and he was sitting there, exhausted, having fought. And General Mark Clark, the American general, drove past in a jeep. And my Uncle Jack says to him, Nadin, are you that Mark Clark? And he went, yes, I am that soldier. He says, well, fighting's that way. Because he got the wrong way for fighting, like generals often do. So he mentions him. It's called Yorkshire Pudding Rules. The tin must not gleam, must never be new. If there's dried sweat somewhere in its metal, it must be your mother's. The flour must be strong and white as the face of Uncle Jack when he came back from the desert. The eggs must come from an allotment. The allotment must belong to your father-in-law. The eggs have to be broken with one swift movement over the bowl. If there's dried sweat somewhere in its Pyrex, it must be your mother's. The milk must have been delivered by Colin Leach at 0430. The fork has to be an old one. The wrist must, simply must, ache after the mixing. The flour must introduce itself to the yolk of the egg. The egg has to be allowed to talk to the flour. The milk must dance with them both, foxtrot, then quickstep. The pepper must be scattered, black on off-white. The oven must be hotter than ever. The lard has to come in a tight white pack. The lard must almost catch fire in the oven. The oven door must open and you must shout, "Jesus Christ!" as the heat smacks you in the chops. Follow these rules and your puddings will rise to heaven and far beyond. And the thing was, I was doing that at the cathedral and the bishop sat on the front row and I realised that I daren't say the words Jesus Christ in that context in the poem. And it's really hard to think and talk at the same time. I've just mastered the art of walking and talking at the same time with the aid of flashcards. And I thought, I'll think of something. And instead of saying Jesus Christ, I said Jerry Crust, which is ridiculous. And the bishop stood up and said, well, it says Jesus Christ in my copy of the book. I said, oh, I'm sorry. It must be a special edition. So I do go to lots of schools as a point, and I find that when you go to schools, I find that secondary school head teachers are obsessed to a strange degree with their school hall. And you walk in the school, they go, have you seen the hall? You go, to be honest, I've seen thousands. They say, you must come and see the hall. The parents made it themselves from egg boxes. It was a wee too big supper. And you have to be excited by this hall. You have to go, well, I've seen some halls in my time, but that's the very best. They go, no, that's the cupboard. Come and look at the hall. I go, I'm sorry. And I went to one place and they said, we'd like to show you the hall, but we can't. I said, oh, why not? And they said, there's a hole in the hall. And I thought, what a great phrase that is, the hole in the hall. So I've written a poem called The Hole in the Hall. And it's published by Oxford University Press. And the great thing about them is they pay you by the line. So what you do is you write a short, fat poem and cut it in half. That's what we poets call structure. I got £96 for this. I shouldn't have spent it all on clothes, I realise, on that hot day in 1981. Often during this one, somebody turns to their neighbour and says the words, it's too daft to laugh at, which is what my mother said about Bonanza. And that got a repeat. But I used to cry every week on Bonanza when they set fire to map. And my mum would say, no, there'll be another map next week, and there always was. I'm glad you remember Bonanza, because sometimes younger members of the audience don't, but I'm glad you do. So it's called The Hole in the Hall. And at the end, people go, £96 for that. It started just like any other day. We had assembly, we sang, we went back to our rooms, the day the hall appeared in the hall. Suddenly, we could no longer see the piano, the day the hall appeared in the hall. The head sent a girl to look. She never came back. I got her pencils, the day the hall appeared in the hall. The head sent a teacher to look. He never came back. I got his pencils, the day the hall appeared in the hall. So the head sent me to look. I never came back. I'm writing this from the hole in the hall with one of the pencils. That's the best line, to be honest, but it carries on for another £35. Sometimes my parents stand at the edge, telling me to come home, out of the hall in the hall. I've got to know the girl. She's called Lucy, and the teacher is called Frank. I play the piano and we sing. Here we are in the hall in the hall, having a ball in the hall in the hall, and we'll never come out of the hall in the hall at all. £96 for that. Now, the thing about that is, it's edited. Thank you very much. The thing about that is, it was in an anthology edited by a guy called John Foster. And I find it interesting. There's a lot of poets in the audience who know this. It's a kind of growth industry with writing poems for young people, writing poems for schools. So John Foster would write to me and he'd go, I want some poems about schools for 8 to 12-year-olds. So he'd send some in and sometimes he'd publish them, sometimes he didn't. And it was a bit like being commissioned to write a poem. So he wrote to me, John Foster. There's quite a few of these editors. There's another one called Paul Cookson. Very good poet. I'd recommend him. He rang me up. He said, I'm doing a book of poems about elderly relatives. Can you write a poem about elderly relatives? I said, what, grandmas and granddads? Because I'm a granddad. I enjoy being a granddad. It was a surprise to us all, to be honest with you, especially my daughter. Because what happened was, we just had our silver wedding, me and my wife. And we said, in a couple of years, the kids will all be off our hands. And my daughter came in and went, I'm pregnant. I went, oh, and she went, I don't love my boyfriend, so I'm going to stay at home. Well, no, don't you love him just a bit? Just a little tiny bit. But then she had little Thomas, who's my grandson, he's my pride and joy, and that was all right. But I thought, said to him, shall I go back, further back? been grandmas and granddads. I said, yeah, have a go. So I've written this. It's called An Interesting Fact About One of My Relatives. My great, 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 great granddad is very old. It's amazing, really. And I went to a school once. He said, we've adapted one of your poems for the mixed choir. I said, oh, really? And that was the one. It was fantastic. They're all still going, my great, great, great. Marvellous. And then there's another editor called Brian Moses. Nice man, lives in a basket. He rang me up. He said, look, I'm doing a... Some places don't get that one. He rang me up. He said, look, I'm doing a book of puzzle poems for infants. I said, what do you mean, puzzle poems? He said, well, you could have an acrostic down the side. You could have a hidden word in the middle. I thought, all right. So I thought some of them. Then just for a joke, I got some nursery rhymes and swapped some of the words in the nursery rhyme for the word fish, just for a laugh. And I sent it off and he published it. I didn't mean him to. So this is now being studied in schools throughout Britain. There's two schools in particular where I hope they're doing it. One school I went to in Cambridgeshire, where the teacher was called Mrs. Daft, which is a sad name for a teacher. And my wife had written the name down wrong on the pad. She put ring Mrs. Duft. So I rang her up. I said, can I speak to Mrs. Duft? She went, actually, it's Mrs. Daft. Now, being an old professional, I don't normally get the giggles, but I did. It went, ha-ha, Mrs. Daft. All I want to know is how to get to your school from the station. She went, I'll get my husband, Dick. I thought, oh, no, Dick Daft. What a great name. Dick Daft, private eye. So I got to school. I thought, if I don't say a name, I'll be all right. I said, hello, I'm here to work with the top class. She went, oh, you mean Mrs. Daft? I said, I'll be back in a minute. And the thing was, the kids were used to it. They didn't think it was funny. And eventually, and then this is a true story. I tell this story a lot. And about 5 years ago, I was telling that story, and Mrs. Daft was in the audience. I didn't know. And I told that story, and she stood up, and she said, yes, it was me. And for once in my life, I was struck dumb when it's Mrs. Daft. And the other school I hope they're doing it at is a school I went to in Gloucestershire, not far from Newent, a little village called Picklenash. A little tiny school, just 15 kids in the school and two teachers. And the school uniform was a T-shirt with a smiley face and the words, We Love Picklenash. And they're all sat there with this, We Love Picklenash. And the teacher had, We Love Picklenash, dinner ladies, We Love Picklenash. I did an hour and a half's poems and got no laughs at all. And at the end, the teacher stood up and said, well, children, we do lots of poetry in our school, and then this gentleman's shown us a different way. I thought, oh, well, at least I don't live in Picklenash. They gave me a free Picklenash T-shirt. Very kind of them. I threw it out at a train window somewhere near Chepstow. And it got it in Western Morning News. So, it's meant to be daft. It's meant to be silly, but it's just, the publisher didn't believe that infants would be clever enough to get that it was meant to be daft, so I had to put a note in. Note, the code increased in difficulty, but here's a clue, it's a bit fishy. See if you can crack it, good luck. One, an easy one. Jack and Jill went up the fish to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his fish, and fish came tumbling after. That was an easy one. I was at a school once in Lancashire, and the teacher stopped me at that point. He said, is that all you do? I said, yes. He said, is it all on that level? I said, I'm afraid so. He said, have you nothing else? I said, no. He said, it's not what we want. I said, it's all I've got. He said, you may as well go. Fantastic, I got the day off. I do like working in Lancashire, but I find you can't get a cup of tea out of them. Because you go back to their house and they go, do you not want a cup of tea? I go, I don't know, you haven't asked me yet. Will you not be having a cup of tea? I don't know. Have you not had one yet? I'm not sure. I think what's interesting to me is the way that language changes all over Britain. I'm lucky enough that a lot of my life is spent going up and down Britain, listening to people talking in different ways. I love the fact that accents are different everywhere. A lot of my relatives come from North Derbyshire, from Chesterfield, where they call their house their arse. It's fantastic. My Auntie Mabel used to say, I've just had double glazing fitted in my arse, Arian. Have you? I've had an extension put on my arse, a wooden extension put on my arse. I've got a detached arse. I used to have a private arse, now I've got a council arse. I got lost in West Bromwich trying to find the station. And I said to this fella, how do I find the station in West Brom? He says, you turn left at Toys Yam Wee. Toys R Us. Yes, you're right. Very good. That's what they call a slow burn. In about half an hour, and I'm doing a really serious poem, they'll still be laughing at that. That's great. So this one, a more difficult one. Little fish harness sat fish a fish, eating a Christmas fish. He fished in his fish and said, fish, 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 plum. And said, fish, 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 aye. I was at a school once. His teacher jumped on stage at that point and went, I know that one. And went off again. Made me laugh unprofessionally. This next one. Many years ago, I was invited to Eton College. And the teacher was called Magnus Basharat. I remember that. He said, hello, my name's Magnus Basharat. I teach at Eton College. I said, are you one of the workshop Basharats? He said, my boys, that gets a laugh, he works up for reasons I can't fathom. He said, my boys are doing your poems for A-level. I said, really? He said, can you come and read to us? I said, yes. He said, what do you charge? So I thought, Eton College. So I tripled my fee. And he went, oh, is that all? I went, oh. And
At the time, it was when Prince William was at Eton College, and my two daughters fancied him. They said, can you get Prince William's autograph? I said, I'll have a go. And Prince William sat there on the front row, but I didn't lunge forward with my autograph book, because next to him, he got the most obvious minder you've ever seen in your life, with a gun under his jacket, so I never got his autograph. But this next one was the only one he laughed at all night. I think he was laughing. He went, shh, 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 shh. I said, you all right? He said, that's how he laughs. He had a man to clap for him. That's true. He said, I enjoyed that. Bring down the underclapper. That was a good one. Sometimes he had the underclapper and the overclapper. It's a very difficult one. And there's actually a couple of key words in this that makes you realise what nursery rhyme it is. Fish, fish. Fish, 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 wall. Fish, fish. Fish, fish, great fish. Fish, 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 fish. And fish, 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 fish. Fish, 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 again. Humpty Dumpty. Yes, well done. And then I was thinking about, somebody rang me up and said, can you do a poem about maths? I said, what kind of maths? He says, well, I'm doing a television programme about maths, and I want to do that kind of maths where you go shopping, but you haven't got a list, so you forget to buy the bread. I said, oh, that maths. He says, can you give me an example of what you might eat if you got no bread? I said, yes, boiled egg with deserters. He didn't get it either, but I thought I'd put in the poem. Yeah, soldiers, that's right, yeah, so telling each other, soldiers, yeah. He said, this poem, it's got to be 20 lines long, it's got to start and finish with the same line, and rhyme first line, third line, second line, fourth line. I said, right, I can do that. I wrote the poem, he rang up, he said, I quite like lines 6 and 7. I said, oh, good, he said, but not in that order. I said, oh, fair enough. And it's really hard to think of things you might eat if you've got no bread, but I wrote this, it's called No Bread. I wish I'd made a list, I forgot to get the bread. If I forget it again, I'll be dead. We have blank and butter pudding, beans on zip. Boiled egg with deserters, no chip, butty, just chip. I wish I'd made a list, I forgot to get the bread. My mum got the empty bread bin and wrapped it round my head. Our jam san, this is just jam floating on the air. We spread butter on the table because the bread wasn't there. It's quite philosophical, that, isn't it? My mum says, if I run away, she knows I won't be missed. Not like the bread was, I wish I'd made a list. And then, thinking about that, somebody said to me, can you do us a poem about, you've got to have the hidden, again about bread. This fellow's obsessed with bread. He said, I want you to write a poem where somewhere in the poem is hidden part of a loaf. I said, well, how do you do that? He said, just hide part of a loaf in the bread, in the poem, I mean. I thought, well, how do you do that? He said, then he rang back. He said, can you make it subtle? I said, well, this is Ian McMillan you're talking to, but I'll have a go. So it's quite a hard one, this. It's called Spot the Hidden Part of a Loaf. Somewhere in the poem. See if you can spot it. Look carefully, because within this poem is hidden crust. The name of part of a loaf. This crust part of a loaf is just in the poem for a laugh. Somebody crust said to me, I bet you can't hide part of a loaf in a poem. Crust. Have you spotted it yet? I did a show once, this bloke went to it and he says, I think it's crust. I says, yes, I think you're right. And many years ago, I wrote a book called Dad the Donkey's on Fire. And we've actually got some copies here tonight, so I'm going to read some poems from that. I don't often, because it's a book I have not seen myself for quite a while. And it's some interesting stuff in it, interesting poems, so it's nice to read these. I was always interested in Ted Hughes as a lad. I liked Ted Hughes. And then, as I got older, I liked Ted Hughes even more, but I also liked Elvis Presley. And then I thought, you know, I've never seen him in the same room. And then the older Elvis got, the bigger his quiff got. And the older Ted Hughes got, the bigger his quiff got. And I wondered if they could be the same person. I wondered if Ted Hughes and Elvis Presley could be the same man. So I wrote this poem called Ted Hughes is Elvis Presley. And it purports to be a poem written by Ted and Elvis at the same time. So it could be that he is. It's called Ted Hughes is Elvis Presley. I didn't die that hot August night. I faked it. Stuffed a Barnard's balloon into a jumpsuit. Left it slumped on the bathroom floor. Hitched a ride on a rig rolling to New York. Climbed into the rig. The driver said, hey, you are... Yeah, the big bopper. I faked it. Never died in that plane crash. Keep it under your lid. I tapped his hat with me porky fingers. He nodded. We shared a big secret. Laid low a while in New York. Saw me funeral on TV in a midtown bar. A woman wept on the next stool but one. He was everything to me. Everything. I've got a hank of his hair in my bathroom and one of his shoelaces taped to my shoulder blade. It was a slob, I said. She looked at me like I was poison. He was too big, I said. He wanted to be small, like a little fish you might find in a pond. I needed a new identity. People were looking at me. A guy in the subway asked me if I was Richie Valance. So I jumped a tramp steamer, heading for England, worked me passage as a cook. In storms, the eggs slid off the skillet. Made me way to London, saw a guy with a briefcase, followed him down the alley, put me blade into his gut, and as the blood shot, I became him. Like Mama used to say, the loaf became Jesus. I am Elvis Presley. I am Ted Hughes. At me poetry readings, I sneer and rock me hips. I stride the moors in a white satin jumpsuit, bloated as the full moon. Bless me soul, what's wrong with me? At night, I sit in my room and I write, and the great bulbous me slaps a huge shadow on the wall. I look up. Outside, a fox peers at me. I sing softly to it, strumming my guitar. Soon all the foxes and the jaguars and the pigs and the crows are gathering outside my window, peering in. I sing Wooden Heart, Blue Hawaii. There is the small applause of paws and feathers. I am Ted Hughes. I am Elvis Presley. I am down at the end of Lonely Street, and a jumpsuit rots in a southern coffin as people pay their respects to a barrage balloon. I sit here. I can feel the evening shrinking me, smaller and smaller. I've almost gone. Ted. 3 inches long. Perfect. Elvis. Ted. So it might be. You never know, it might be him. And then, my dad, the aforementioned dad, I was asking him, I said, how did you learn to read and write? Way back in Scotland in the early 20s. And he said, what they had? They had a set of wooden blocks with the letters of the alphabet on, and he learnt from them. And then his sister, Nancy, had kept one of these blocks, and she gave it to him not long before she died. And this block, it only had one letter on, the letter K. He said, yeah, that's the one I remember most. I thought, blimey, just imagine if that's all you had to learn the alphabet from, the letter K. So this poem's called Cake Yourself Comfortable. Come in, sit down, get yourself comfortable, cup of tea, bit of cake, kilt, cugger. My problem, you kish to discuss it. Ah, yes, the letter K. Well, Kitoko's cactical childhood. We were very poor. We only had one koi. A building crit with ketters on. Except all the ketters have been cubbed off except Con. All my childhood, I corner ever saw Con letter. The letter S. That's a daft joke at the end. But don't really fit in with the rest of the poem. And then, a poem a bit like that is somebody rang me up and they said, we're doing this. It was when Front Row first started on Radio 4. They said, we'd like to write a poem that starts with a line, that famous poetry line of T.S. Eliot's, April is the cruelest month. And can you write me something like that? And I thought, well, the way to get round that, to make it unusual, because I always try and write things that are a bit unusual, I thought, wouldn't it be good if you got a dog called April is the cruelest month? And it's one of those ideas that you think's great until you get to about the third verse. So it's called My Dog. April is the cruelest month. Might seem like a strange name for a dog. I think you'll agree that's two of the great lines in literature. April is the cruelest month might seem like a strange name for a dog, and sometimes I think it is, when I'm shouting her name on the high moors in the driving wind. April is the cruelest month, I shout. April is the cruelest month. And my dog runs up to me, barking, wagging her tail, and I feel slightly, ever so slightly, embarrassed. But then, when people say, as they walk by me on the high moors in the driving wind, can a month bark, can April wag its tail, I swell with pride, because my dog's name is image and metaphor and poetry. So, April is the cruelest month, I shout, and April is the cruelest month. And the words roll round my mouth like Easter eggs in a shopping basket, which is the name of my cat. That's another one that kind of ends in that way. And then, I think what happens is, a lot of poets in the room will know this, when you write poems, you end up writing the same kind of poems. You write poems, here we go again, here's an Ian Macmillan poem, here's a poem by me, here's a poem by me that does certain things. And I found in the end, I thought, what's the point in making stuff up? Why make things up? I'll just write down what happens. And this is a number of years ago. She mentions my son, Andrew, who was also a poet when he was a little lad. And it's just about, I thought it was a hot summer's night. I thought, I'm just going to write down what happens when I walk in the house. So I'll explain the poem, then I'll do it. And what happened was, I walked in the house, and I thought, I'm not going to write it all down. There was this enormous moth, about as big as this book, flying around the room. And my wife was emptying the washing machine, and she's trying to flick the moth at the door with one of her bras. And I thought, what's the point in making out up? And then she said, come and give me a hand with this moth. So I tried to walk across the room, but our Andrew had been playing under the ironing board with some of my dad's old fishing wire, so I couldn't walk like that. And then That night, we were laid in bed, and my wife always sleeps very soundly. But that night, she sat up in bed for the first and only time in our marriage, and she said something. She went, "The big wheel is going round." Then went back to sleep. I thought, blimey, there's no point making out up. And then, that night, before we'd gone to bed, my daughter came in and went, "It's time for the hedgehog." And we all went like that. Because that summer, every night at the same time, a hedgehog walked past our window, and we all sat and watched it, because nothing else happens round our way. And then, the next day, I was on the bus going to a school, and because it was a warm night, it felt like there might be a storm, and there was a fella sat behind me, and he said to his mate, "There's a storm in air." And his mate says, "Ah, best place for it." And I thought, that's fantastic. Put that in the poem. And then, a little kid came up to me in the classroom, and he went, "You know that song, 'The Sun Has Got His Hat On'?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "It means it's cloudy." I thought, hey, that's clever. So, I put all them in the poem, and then, the only thing I made up in the whole poem was the title. The title is, "Poem Containing Several R.E.M. Song Titles." And there's none in it. And I sent it off to a publisher, and he said, "I can only find four." I said, "Oh, I've not got all their albums." But I think once you've met me tonight, you'll have been sprinkled with a kind of Ian Macmillan dust. And when you go home, interesting things will happen. You'll see interesting notices. You'll find things. You'll overhear things. When I was in Winchester yesterday, on the way down on the train, this amazing thing happened that one day I'll turn into a poem. There was an elderly gentleman sat in front of me. Must have been his 70s or probably his 80s. I can normally guess people's ages, men. He was probably in his 80s. He sat there. Suddenly his phone started ringing. Because his phone probably rang very rarely, he didn't think it was his. So he's looking around like that. Then eventually he realises it's his. And he picks it up and it's getting louder and louder. And it's one of these old phones that you have to open up like that to answer. And he opened it up and he looked at it and he went, "Ah." And he answered it and he went, "Dad? Dad?" And I thought, blimey. That is fantastic. Then I had to get off the train and he carried on down to Bournemouth. I thought, oh, God. Things like that, we should remember. So this is just one of them. It just says you should never make anything up because things happen to you. It's called Poem Containing Several R.E.M. Song Titles. It's a hot summer's evening. My wife flicks a moth out the door with her bra. It could have been my shirt or the Radio Times. The sun has got his hat on and the garden's almost dark. The hedgehog will be out soon. The big wheel's going round, says my wife, in a different place and a different time. I'd like to help with the moth, but I'm all tangled up with some fishing line that my son left under the ironing board. So I'm like a swan, tangled in the invisible knots that can choke you, or at least stop you flying. There's a storm somewhere in the air, which is the best place for it. It's hard to be a moth, or a swan, or a hedgehog, or a big wheel, R.E.M. song titles, spot them all. No more in there, perhaps there aren't, I don't know. And then, I've always tried to write different kinds of things, and what I love about coming to Ledbury Festival is that I can just try new things out, try different things. And recently, I've been working with my friend Tony Husband, the great cartoonist. When we came here last, about 6 or 7 years ago, we did our show, A Cartoon History of Ledbury. And we worked together in trying to do a thing about the First World War. And we were thinking about that wonderful story, whether it's true or it's a myth or it's grown in the telling, about when they had that truce at Christmas 1914, where they played football with the German soldiers. And obviously, that story's grown in the telling. And me and Tony thought, what about if we had a couple of cartoonists, an English cartoonist and a German cartoonist, and they came together and they threw cartoons to each other across the front line, and maybe that would be a way of getting people together through laughing. So I'll just read a few verses from this new book. And it's I tried to write it in a certain way, in six-line verses that rhymed first line, second line, third line, fourth line, then fifth and sixth line rhyming. And I do like these kind of restrictions. It gets harder the further on you get through the book, but I like that kind of restriction. And it imagines this place, a bit like where I live in Barnsley, and these men who, as we know, marched off to war thinking it might be over by Christmas, and it just imagines this group of friends, including Walter the pencil man, who is the cartoonist, and then it imagines them in the Somme. Imagine this, a pit village, 1914, a row of houses standing in the cold, a covering of snow has settled on the green, a winter sun is shining like fool's gold. Men are standing, talking in the Queen's Head Yard. The air is tight and frosty and the sky is hard. Picture this, a sea of sludge, 1917. You just can't see the army for the dirt. Stumbling through the morning like a war machine, built from fear and trembling blood and hurt. Look closely though, familiar faces loom through fog. Silence snapped in two by a barking dog. Something links these worlds across the seasons, the years. A long unbroken line from there to there. Those Queen's Head boys with nervous laughter forming beers, grins like horses, windswept ruffled hair, and these stumbling zombies with faces like screams that populate your night times, infiltrate your dreams. Look closer. See that soldier with the nervous eyes, the pit lad with a pencil in his hand. Time and pain buzzed round them like a swarm of flies. They marched down to the station with the band, and the snow fell down like feathers, freezing white, and the train rolled through the farmland in the night. And then, towards the end of the book, Lars, who is the German cartoonist, and Walter get together. Lars sees Walter drawing from the confines of his trench. Walter chews his pencil. Lars recognises this as a common human gesture rising high above the stench and the grip of battle's all-embracing kiss. Tears stream down his face, mingle with the spit that's dribbling down his chin and dropping in the shit. Lars does something scary, something foolish, something mad. He clambers from the trench, runs across the dirt to where Walter is drawing a small image of his dad, trying to cover Walter from the pain and hurt that war is pouring down onto his son's pale head. Lars says nothing, but begins to draw instead. Impossible, I suppose, far-fetched, a fantasy. A made-up Angels of Mons-type tale that's nothing more than a fictional story you can tell the kids when you've had some ale. But Walter and Lars sat and drew that day, and they didn't speak, and they had plenty to say. Somehow, what they drew came from both their hearts. Somehow, what they drew was louder than a gun. One would finish something that the other seemed to start. They knew what they were doing, though they'd only just begun. Walter drew, Lars drew, they drew together. Something happened there that day, a change in the weather. A pause occurred, not silence or near silence, but a shift in the noise that shook the ground and broke the sky. And in a moment, Lars was gone, like smoke goes from a drift to a breath of nothing, fading like a memory of a sigh. He dropped his pencil as he ran. It lay there. Walter turned and picked it up and kept it as the dark air throbbed and burned. This is a moment in a harsh and pointless war when something changes, when art is moved along and taken to a place it hasn't been before. Like when walking turned to dance, a shout became a song. Like when the poets of World War I held the future in their verses because the past had gone. We all know the story, how the young poets changed, how Owen and Brooke had their lives turned round, how in the face of war the very language rearranged and poetry was fashioned that recognised the sound of bullets and bombs and weeping and worse could be fashioned and bullied and shaped into verse. Walter was drawing till the page almost caught fire, one of a soldier holding out a helping hand. As the pile of bodies round him grew bloodily higher, one of a corpse of severed limbs growing from the land. Something altered in Walter that morning. Something came close to Walter's ringing ear and whispered Walter's name. Maybe that's what happens in the blast and sweat of war. Your mind pulls up new ideas from somewhere deep inside. Something can be thought of that's not been thought before. Other pathways can be walked on, other methods tried. Or is it just a young kid doing the only thing he can? Drawing might be the answer when you haven't got a plan. And it carries on like that, and towards the end, there's a lovely bit where Walter and Lars just wave to each other across the thing, and in the end, it ends tragically, but I just wanted to do a thing that maybe talked about war and talked about art and talked about that kind of thing. And some of these books are on sale this evening, I'm pleased to say. So, moving on. How are we doing for time, by the way? Because I've got another book in. It's in November next year. Keep going. Nobody said that to me for years. That's good. So, thinking about what I was talking about before, about getting a bit older, I was thinking about... I'm a big fan of two things. I like avant-garde music, or as my wife calls it, haven't practiced. Or haven't got a clue. I like the kind of music that empties the room. I love music that sounds like a squeaky gate. But it's really hard to describe it. It's really hard to describe avant-garde music. You end up calling it a squeaky gate or, you know, a fire in a pet shop. That kind of description. And the other thing I like, I love apples. I've eaten about 5 apples already today. But last year was a great year for what I call feral apples, where apples... Somebody's chucked an apple core out of a car window and it grows at side of road or sometimes at the side of train lines. I love picking those kinds of apples and putting them in, sometimes stewing them, making pies out of them. And this is just about those two things. I thought I'd write a poem about those two things, about feral apples and about my love of avant-garde music. It's also about the fact that, because I'm well known round my way, I often get heckled. People heckle me. When I've been on the telly, because they don't like to hear people talking, I've been on breakfast telly recently doing the papers, and I went in the paper shop the next day, and this fella says to me, "We saw your aunt telly yapping." Because it's not seen as the dumb thing for a Yorkshire person to yap. And in fact, I was walking through Womwell, the next village to where I live, not long ago, and I was walking down the street in Womwell, and this car slowed down. This contains strong language, but it's okay, we're past the threshold. I was walking down the street. This man wound a window down and went, "Here, Matt Millen." I went, "Yeah." He said, "You're on the radio." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You're on the telly." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You write poems." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You're shite." And he drove off like that. I thought, God bless him. And this person appears. He appears in this poem. My mate. He appears in this poem. It's just about that, and it's also about my dad, who, like me, liked a bit of music, but not, as we know, it was Andy Stewart and Sandy Shaw. And also about the fact that, the book, is the title poem of this little booklet, and it's called "I've Soiled My Breeks," and that might give you a clue. Because it's also about the fact that, as you know, gentlemen in the audience, if you drink too many cups of coffee, you got to be careful. So it's called "I've Soiled My Breeks," and it tries to describe this kind of music that I like. Start with this. Kitchen light slattered through blinds on a Friday morning's opening statement of intent. Soundtrack is avant-garde jazz, squealing and groaning from an iPad's mouth. A man in armour is falling downstairs, it seems, and it's making him whistle and punch a cello. Ian's plunging the plunger on a pot of black coffee. The best bit of drinking it is plunging the plunger. Plunge, Ian, wait, let it stand. Try not to think of the apples. The slattered light alters slightly. It's the post lady with a parcel to sign for. "What's that row?" she says, nodding at the noise. Ian signs. He's thinking of a reply, but she's gone. Poor slurp. Now he can think of the apples. Feral apples, he calls them. The ones you see hanging on trees by the side of the road, by the railway line as the train slows down, red and green stop-and-go signs you can make pies with. And today, Ian is going with a carrier bag from Aldi to pick some. Poor slurp. The jazz increases in volume and intensity. Now, two alligators are fighting over the ownership of a gate that needs oiling. And that music forms a bumpy bridge to the next section of this poem, where Ian is scrambling down to a hedge by the A635 between Darfield and Ardsley with his carrier bag. A passing artisan in a car shouts through an open window, "Your poems are shite," to the scrambling bard, and a crow caws. Ian bends and picks red ferals from the floor, picks red ferals from a branch, ignores the feeling of tightness in a place he'd rather not think about. Ah, the joy of the feral apple collector and avant-garde music fan. Carrier bagging the beauties as tractors fields away, and that crow and apple landing in bag sounds combine to make a music that should, really should, win awards. Too much coffee. He needs a wee. So, let's let the avant-garde music swell again to take us to the next location for this poem. Actually, it's a double scene, so the music will resemble the mixing of Yorkshire puddings with the shattering of a stained glass window by a robot seagull. Scene, a village in the Scottish borders. My dad emerging with a smile and an up thumb from a toilet at the back of a garage. It's the mid-1970s, so the attendant still served you and one of them's smiling. Dad's zip is still open. Scene, a hospital room. My dad is slumped. His stroke has stroked him, but not like a lover. He looks past me and says in a voice far away in the distance, "I've soiled my breeks." Music is rising, and now it's a storm at sea as described by a Martian, and it takes us to the next part of this poem where Ian's walking as fast as he can down the A635. A jogger passes and shouts, "Soon be time for a cuppa." The music stays under this next bit as Ian walks faster, thinking of deserts and sand dunes and a box of dry lentils. The post lady waves from her passing van. "Don't wave, you bugger, give me a lift." Time is measured in water, I suppose. You start as a trickle of a stream in the high hills, and you grow and mature into a wide river, and people use you for pleasure and work, and they splash around in you, or they gaze into you, looking for reflections of themselves, and eventually you overflow your banks. You overflow your banks. You almost make it. You get to the door. It's locked. You stagger round the back into the garden. You almost make it. You are carrying red feral apples in an Aldi bag, and you almost make it. How much of an inland patio sea can a few cups of coffee make? More than you think. I've soiled my breeks. Let the music enter a thoughtful phase. Let it sound like fruit. Because what happened was, I got to the house. I thought, I'm all right now. My wife had locked the door. I went round the back, and a release occurred. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a frightening thing. Went all over the path. And then I was really embarrassed. I said to my wife, something terrible's happened. I went, what? I went, I've wet my pants. She went, don't worry, it'll happen to us all. I thought, great, that's why I married her. And then, because I'm well known, people give me poems on the street. They're always giving me poems. When I go home tomorrow, I've been away for 2 nights. That means several people will have put poems through my letterbox. People give me on the street, hello Ian, here's a poem. There used to be a fellow around bars, he called Monologue Frank. And he'd come, I'd be sitting on a cup of tea with my wife in a cafe. He'd come, hello Ian, hello, here's one for you. You'll like this one, just a quick one, quick monologue for you. And this is about my other mate, Norman. Now, Norman, he often stops me on the street and just tells me things. I just write them down. And this is one of them. It's called Norman Stopped Me on the Street. And it's about the fact, I think about that great poet, Tony Addison, who said that people with voices like mine are only ever going to be the comedy ones in Shakespeare, as though somehow we can't be profound. And I think we can. I think anybody with any kind of accent can be profound. This is Norman. Norman stopped me on the street. Norman stopped me on the street and he said, "Hey, Ian lad, I could go to theatre if I wanted, I reckon. I could sit there and clap at end and shout more. Then I'd go home and say, 'Where have you been? To shop? To bus stop? To wall? To shed? I've been to theatre. I've got a programme. I could do that, Ian. No stopping me, is there?' No, Norman, there's nothing stopping you at all." And then, Norman then, he started writing poems. And he started giving me poems. And this is him. "Give me a poem." Some poems that he gave me. And no, it's not in that one, it's in this one. It's my new book called Jazz Peas. Because I like jazz and I like peas. And the great thing about being a poet is you can call your books whatever you want. Nobody will tell you off. Sadly, they went mad at them in Winchester last night. I think they'd never seen the printed word before, so I've got none left. So this is Norman. Norman came to my house and said, "Right, Ian, I've written a poem. Can I show thee it? It don't rhyme, and it's about me thoughts about England. And it were right hard not to make it rhyme, but I think I managed it. Modern poem, thou sees. They don't have to rhyme, do they, modern poetry? I'll leave it with thee." Later, I rang Norman to talk to him about his poem. His answering machine was Norman with a phone voice. The score is Barnsley 6, Manchester United 0. And the second half is about to start. So he'll understand that I can't get to the phone right now. "It's okay, Norman. I'll ring back later to talk about modern poetry." Because what struck me about that was that even Norman thought he had to put a voice on the phone. And then the poem's called, the book's called Jazz Peas, and the first poem is about that. It's about the fact that me and my mate Dave Sunderland loved jazz, avant-garde jazz, whatever jazz. In the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, used to be able to get it on Voice of America radio station. But the reception wasn't very good, so it kept fading away. So we'd sit and listen, and so we'd sit there in Dave Sunderland's house with lights off, pretending we were in a jazz club in America, listening to this Voice of America. Because if we had curtains open and it were dark outside, every so often, about once an hour, the 14 bus would go by and the headlights would sweep across the room and we'd snap his fingers pretending we were in a jazz club. I know it's pathetic, but I thought... He mentions the Casa Disco, which was Barnsley's one record shop. And Dave Sunderland's mum used to play organ in chapel. And we knew if it were a long service, we'd have more time to listen to jazz. It's called Me and Dave and Thelonious Monk Waiting for the 14 Bus. Another Friday evening in Dave Sunderland's front room. Another new LP bought in the jazz section of Casa Disco. Another night when Dave's mum was out at the chapel. "Turn it up, Dave. Turn it right up. Turn the lights out, Dave. And let's wait." Another track on the underground album, Ugly Beauty. Another rearrangement of time and space and coincidence. Another listen, "Dave, put it on again, mate. Soon be time." In the front room dark, we try to snap our fingers and it sounds like rain on a soft roof. Another few moments to wait if the 14 bus is on time. Another double-decker light / modern jazz moment. Another adolescent evening spent wishing we could leave here. Round the corner by the station inn, the 14 bus. Monk's music redefines so much, so much. The 14's lights light up the room, sweet over it, away. Another hour to wait before the next 14 bus, Dave. Another biscuit from the tin. I'll tell you what, let's pretend it's a whiskey biscuit. Another magical moment, Dave. Thelonious, the 14, the light. Play it again until your mum comes in. She said she was bringing chips and mushy peas. We'll pretend the jazz peas, Dave. Jazz peas. Because we thought that if you said the word jazz before anything, it'd be great. Oh, jazz peas, right? Jazz peas. Just do a few more, then we'll stop. Can I just say what a great listening there is in this room? It's a fantastic... I like coming to Ledbury. I do so many gigs in front of people who don't really want to be there. But it's so nice just to be in a room full of people who like poetry. It's such a great thing for me. It's so nice. So, again, going back to this book that's near us. I've always lived in Darfield, and my grandson lives in Grimethorpe, and he plays for the local football team, and his trainer, a kid called Dave, who's got the word Barnsley born and bred tattooed on his leg, he always says the same thing, goes, "Thomas," that's my grandson, "Thomas, use your right hand leg." And that confuses me and Thomas, it confuses. So I said to him for a joke, I says, "What about his left hand foot?" He says, "Don't be so daft." And He also does that thing, Dave the trainer, where he says the words of popular songs rather than singing them. So he'll be stood there. And he's always doing Tom Jones songs. So when he's getting ready for match, he's going, it's not unusual to have fun with anyone. And it's like, it becomes weird, it's weird. And this is something that happened at the football the other day. It was called Tom Jones. It's got a little chorus, which I do myself. My right hand leg, my left hand foot. The old town looks the same as I step down from the train. I was refereeing a rugby match in Grimethorpe. My right hand leg, my left hand foot. And a kid on a motorbike came across the pitch. Right across the pitch. And there to meet me is my mama. My right hand leg, my left hand foot and papa. Sacks of coal tied to the back of the bloody bike. And do you know what I did? My right hand leg, my left hand foot. I blew the bloody whistle. My right hand leg, my left hand foot. Just took me as tragic. This fella drives across the pitch on a motorbike with bags on the back and they blew the whistle. Strange. Another one. This is, I always hear things on the train. And there was a really loud American on train and he kept shouting. He said, I'm studying. I says, yeah. He weren't talking to me, but I was just kind of answering him. But I'm studying. I'm doing French with math. So that I'll put that in the poem. And there's a French poet called Jacques Otte that I like. So I thought I'd put him in the poem and all. So I've done it in capitals because he's shouting. I'm taking French with math. I figure that may help me to stop shouting. The French poetry is really deep. The math is complex, but hey, rewarding. I like Jacques Otte best. His poetry is based on nature, and he's Swiss, not French. Swiss plus French equals poetry. It all adds up. That's what kept shouting. So, I'll do it. Are we out of time? No idea. Keep saying carry on. Carry on. What time is it? I don't know what time it is.
Ten past
what?
Nine.
Well, fire. I told my wife I was only going to the shop. Mind you, it was Meadow Hall, a leisure experience. So I'll do two more, I'll do two more. This first one, two performancey ones. This first one, I've wanted for years to write something about train spotters. I think train spotters are such interesting people. Whenever I go down to London on the train from Doncaster, I go from platform 4 and across platform 8, there's all the train spotters. And I've tried to talk to them, but they think you're going to take the mickey. And you go up to them. I wore a T-shirt that said, Love Me Tender. I thought that might get me to talk to them. And what a great gag that is. So, eventually, I got their confidence. And they started telling me stories about Britain's least successful train spotter, a man called Derek. So I've written a poem about Derek, Britain's least successful train spotter. So I do apologise to any Dereks in the room, particularly any women, but there are certain support groups you can join. Derek's Anonymous. It's a 12-step programme towards becoming a Malcolm. And then, or even a Trevor. And then become Derek Malcolm and you become a film critic. So, and because it's a sad story, I've written it as a kind of hoedown, as a sort of a play against type. So I'll do this one, and then we'll do one we can all join in with, because as you know, poetry is not a cruise ship. There are no passengers, as far as I can see. It's just about Britain's least successful transport. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Got the anorak, got the duffel bag, got the big notebook and the pocket full of pens. Fountain pens and cartridge pens and all those flipping biros. Yes, all those flipping biros, because Derek's ready, Derek's ready, Derek's ready, Derek's ready. For the red light, orange light, green light, go whoosh! Missed it. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Got the sandwiches, got the great big flask, big bag of crisps, pocket full of sweets, chocolate bars and Yorkie bars and all those flipping penguins. Yes, all those flipping penguins. Because Derek's ready, Derek's ready, Derek's ready, Derek's ready. For the red light, orange light, green light, go whoosh! Missed it. Have another go. Have another go. Get a closer look. Get a closer look. At the red light, on his light, green light, go whoosh. Ah! Caught it. Right in the back. Right in the back. Right in the back of the anorak. So now they're spotting Derek. So now they're spotting Derek. Those. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Got the anorak. That's in Wick. Got the duffel bag. That's in Crew. Got the big notebook. That's loose leaf. Covers all the regions. Covers all the regions. Mind you, so does Derek. Mind you, so does Derek. With this red light, on his light, green light, go whoosh. Ha! Train spotter, train spotter, train, train, train. Train spotter, train spotter, train, train. And then I thought we'd have a go at doing one we could join in with, which is about the fact. Oh, thank you for the applause. Thank you very much. It's so nice for me to stand and do a range of stuff. It's such a lovely, lovely festival to do this. I'm not kidding. I must remember to stop talking before I drink the drop. I just said that tonight I've been sponsored. Last night we were sponsored by a kitchen firm. I gave everybody in the audience a spatula. I don't know why I'm telling you that, but it just struck me as a strange thing to do. And I got them all to wear the spatula at various points in the show for no apparent reason. That was great. I just said, it's time to wear the spatula. And they were all very kind. They all wear the spatulas like that for no reason at all. It was great. So I am, in fact, a very unusual man from Barnsley in that I make my living through talking. Because most Barnsley men hardly ever speak. I was in our barbers the other week. They call our barber Mad Jeff in Darfield because he wears a bow tie. That denotes madness in Barnsley. And I was sat in Jeff's, and Jeff's was full. And this man put his head around the door, and he went, ah. And Jeff went, no. And he went, right. And he went out again. And if you could translate that into standard English, it would be, hello, barber, could you fit me before 3:30? No, as you can see, I've got a shop full of customers, sir. Right, then I'll call back this afternoon, my good man, or perhaps tomorrow morning. But it's reduced to, ah, no, right, because we don't like to talk in Barnsley. And also, when people from Barnsley meet each other on the street, they don't say hello, they just do a slight sideways movement of the head. So they meet each other and they go, in fact, I'm doing too much because I'm excited. It's less than that. It's less. It's just, in fact, it's less than that. It's simply, that's all it is. It's barely perceptible to the human eye. And also, when something bad happens to a person from Barnsley, they come out with the Barnsley existential cry of despair, where they go, ee, often accompanied by a shrug. There's that very old Barnsley joke that you all know about the man whose wife died and he wanted the word, she was thine, put on the gravestone. And the stonemason got it wrong and put, she was thin. And he went back and he says, you've missed off the E. So he went back a week after that and he put, E, she was thin. And what a wonderful gag that is. And in fact, we have got a very bad narcotic problem in Barnsley, particularly amongst the pensioners. What happens is they take the false teeth out before they take the drugs. That's E by gum. So this... And in fact, what did the Yorkshireman do when he ran out of sellotape? He buy gum. So they go downhill, don't they? So this has got a bit you can join in with. What happens is I go 1, 2, 3, 4, and you all go E. Well, sometimes what happens is nobody joins in. It's really embarrassing. And you go 1, 2, 3, 4, and they go, no. What's worse than that is one person says it on their own. That's really sad. You go 1, 2, 3, 4, they go, yeah, they have to go and start a new life in Worcester. Which can be done with the aid of coconut oil and crowbars. So I'll give you a couple of seconds to say to each other, I'll say it if you'll say it. Go on, then we may as well. It's Tuesday, gateway to the weekend. Let's have a go. You won't feel silly. You'll feel a certain je ne sais quoi, as they say in Wolverhampton. Let's have a go. So I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, we go E. Because this is a nice room acoustically for it. This will work really well. Let's have a go. So I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, we go E. 1, 2, 3, 4.
E.
Very good. One or two people didn't join in because they thought it gave them a kind of dignity. But in fact, they looked after not joining in, so that's all right. Also, I'm on the radio quite a lot. I've got my own show on Radio 3 on a Friday night called The Verb. When I first started on the radio, my mother used to insist that my dad listened in a separate room on a different radio because she thought it put the ratings up. That's sad, but true. She thought the BBC was a big bank of lights. One more for Macmillan. My dad was in a wheelchair. She used to push him in. Oh, get in there, Ari Inzin. Take them 5 radios with you. But when I first started on the radio, I was at Radio Sheffield. And at Radio Sheffield, they had the world's oldest coffee machine. I didn't realise that when coffee machines were first invented, you didn't get a paper cup. You put your money in, it made the coffee for you, but you had to put your own cup under. And in very small letters at Radio Sheffield, it says, put cup under first. And I always forgot. And I put my money in, and instead of getting a cup of coffee, I got coffee, which is slightly different. And this hot coffee hits you on the hand. And if you're from anywhere else in the world, you go, oh, dear me, hot coffee on the hand. And because you're from Barnsley, you go, ee. More bad news. So, when we've gone E, we have to go, drinks machines, I've never been keen on drinks machines. Let's try that. If you don't know the word, just to the tune. Just go hip and eye, diddle eye, low. Let's have a go. So it's drinks machines, I've never been keen on drinks machines. Quick sip of water, let's have a go. It's called Pure Life by Nestle. Does anybody else hear that strange squeaking noise? What is it? It's a what? It's a mouse. It's either having a good time or a bad time because it's been doing that for about an hour. Let's try it. So I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4. We go drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. 1, 2, 3, 4. Drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. Very good. If you want to at this point, just for the joy that's in it, you can put a comedy whistle in the S. You can go drinks machines, drinks. It'll sound so... I love the comedy whistle of this. I think it's great if you're being told off by a superior. I think it deflates the situation. If they go, look, I'm really annoyed with you, you go, I'm... Sorry. I apologise profoundly and profusely for my misdemeanors on Saturday lights. I think it's worth a try, being told off. So do me if you want. So we'll put the two bits together. So I'll go 1, 2, 3. Those sponsors don't know what they're missing, do they? So I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4. We go E, we go drinks machine. We'll just put it together. So I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4. And we go E, drinks machines, drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. Let's have a go. The mouse has stopped now. 1, 2, 3, 4. E, drinks machines, drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. Good. It's like the asthma clinic, isn't it? So let's... So that's the chorus. You do the chorus, I'll do the verse. You do the verse if you want, but you don't know it. Nothing would happen. You don't be mouth, nothing would come out. But like living in Grimsby, wouldn't it? Let's try it. I guess laughing Grimsby, I don't know why. So we start with the chorus. 1, 2, 3, 4. E! Drinks machines, drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. Coffee, coffee. Tastes like mud. It was ground this morning, so it should. Insert coins, coins return. Insert coins, coins return. Cup drops down, fingers burn. Why do I never learn? Oh. R-O-E, spelt all my flipping T. Time for the chorus. E, drinks machines, drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. A 1P, 2P, 5P, 10, 20P, 50, start again. White, black, extra white, normal whipped, it tastes like dirt. E, drinks machines. I've never been keen on drinks machines. You can get chocolate, you can get pop, don't press that button, it won't stop. Dripping, spilling, slopping, slipping, sliding, screaming, diving, swimming in a sea of chocolate soup, in a sea of chocolate soup. Last time for the chorus. E, drinks machines, I've never been keen on drinks machines. Thank you very much, I'll bow a new clap. I thank you. I thank you. I thank you. I thank you. Come on, man.